Guy Standing, what was it that first alerted you to the emergence of this new class, and why do you call it the precariat?
Well, the analysis started with looking what's happening to work and labour around the world, and it was clear that new class structures are emerging across the world. We've got an elite at the top, these abysmally rich people. Then you've got people still in salaried long-term jobs. And below that, you've got a shrinking working class. And it's below that that this group that's emerging across the world, the precariat, I call it, and other people are also calling it the precariat now, people basically who are in precarious circumstances, not just in their jobs, but in their housing and in their conditions of life and so on. And it's quite clear that millions and millions of people are moving into this status. And the problem is compounded because not only are they living in fearful conditions, but they don't have an occupational identity. They don't feel they're becoming something.
So to what extent are movements like the Occupy movement part of this?
Well, the Occupy movement is an interesting symptom of the development. I was invited to speak to about four of them last year and a number of other meetings in Madrid and in Turin and Rome and various other places. And it's quite clear that there's an angst and a real sense of anger, particularly among young educated people who have been sold a lottery ticket in terms of their education. They're promised a career if they go into university or college. And at the same time, when they come out, they find that they've got debts and very little prospect of actually getting a career-type job. And then they have to adapt to insecurity and all the problems of disappointment. And I think that the Occupy movement was a symptom in the sense, I call it primitive rebels, in the sense that many people know what they're against. They're against the massive inequalities and the insecurities, but so far not quite sure what should be done about it.
So you say that inequality is a key driver. Is the global financial crisis intensifying this class divide?
Well, and certainly it is. I mean, since the financial crisis in 2008, a great sucking sound has developed in the sense that millions more are suddenly threatened with being pushed into the precariat. And the sense of alienation, the sense of anxiety and an anomie, we call it, with a sense of despair, is fueling this growing anger. And the anger is boiling up in different directions. You've got a lot of people who are being pushed into the precariat from old working class communities, and these people tend to look back. They look back and hope that the old style, full-time, stable jobs will be the future. And it's not. That's not going to be the future. But those people tend to be very angry and are easily misled by populist politicians who've got their own dubious motives. But at the same time, there are a lot of other people who are being pushed into the precariat who are educated, they're frustrated, but they're not so easily misled into that sort of neo-fascist populism, I call it. And those people are looking for a much better future where they want to be able to work, they want to be able to develop their competencies and their skills and their connections and so on. And I think what we have to do in social and political terms is reach out to that group and find policies to respond to their frustrations.
Are we talking mainly about people in the developed world reacting to job insecurity and rising inequality, or is it also evident in countries with rapidly growing economies like China and India?
Well, first of all, it is a global phenomenon. It's definitely, I mean, I've been invited to talk about the issues in Delhi, in South Africa, in Brazil, and in Japan. It's definitely a global phenomenon. But clearly, the biggest manifestation of the precariat is in the industrialized world. And I want to emphasize, it's not just one form of insecurity. It's employment insecurity in the sense that people feel they don't have good contracts that stretch into the future. It's job insecurity, which is a different thing, which is not having control of the way they can do their work and develop their skills in work. And it's income insecurity because they often don't know where their income is going to be coming from, what benefits they're likely to receive. And the biggest problem, I think, for the precariat in terms of financial insecurity is the fact that they're being systematically denied access to benefits that previous generation, their parents often, took for granted, like paid holidays, access to a good pension, sick leave, and access to creches and things like that. The precariat just don't even dream of those because they know they're out of their reach. And it's interesting, I've had quite a lot of people contacting me from the Middle East and from Greece, of course, where the Syntagma Square demonstrations have been very much part of the precariat development. And there in the Middle East, you had a mixture of things, obviously, but a large number of the very bravest people who've gone out into the squares have been young, educated people who are now in a terrible situation that the more atavistic Islamic extremists are likely to be coming into power in various places, which is quite alien from their aspirations.
Guy Standing, is this really any different to an underclass in any era?
Well, first of all, I say in the book and demonstrated, I hope, in a number of places, it is definitely not an underclass. It is something that multinational capital and governments have actively sought. An underclass is a sort of drag on society. It's people who are, you know, social misfits. This is a type of labor situation which has been wanted by the international economy. They want a flexible, adaptable supply who can be moved around easily, who can be have the risks of life bear on them rather than on corporations. And the way I put it is that governments in the 1980s and 1990s, governments of all persuasions, essentially made a Faustian bargain. When they liberalized their economies, they automatically trebled the global labor supply because China and India and other countries were suddenly having millions of people available as workers. Of course, those workers were prepared and habituated to be working for a tiny fraction of what an Australian or British worker would expect. And therefore, there was a downward pressure on wages. And the Faustian bargain was basically, okay, we can't have a rush downwards in wages, and we will therefore provide cheap consumer credit, tax credits, subsidies, various types of subsidies, and gradually the wages and working conditions would go down. But in the meantime, there would be a consumer splurge, in effect, an orgy of consumption. Now, the trouble is that any Faustian bargain can only be kept going for, you know, a certain amount of time. And eventually, the Faustian bargain ran out of steam, and we had a huge crash in 2008. And now you're seeing the adjustment at the international level where the rich country governments are introducing austerity budgets in trying to get their deficits down. And as a result, you're going to see a whole lot more cuts in benefits and living standards for the precariat. And this makes it a very dangerous situation that we've got coming up, because unless we have redistribution to reduce this grotesque inequality that has grown, it's not clear how living standards of the precariat are going to be preserved.
Yes, you call this precariat the new dangerous class. Why is it dangerous, and to whom?
Well, I think it's very dangerous in a number of respects. It's dangerous in the first case because most of the people in the precariat, of the different varieties, those coming from well-working-class traditions, those coming from highly educated middle-class traditions, if you like, are angry in the sense they don't identify with the mainstream political parties of the last century. So they're dangerous because they then start listening to more extremist views, and those politicians are playing on the fears and insecurities and are demonizing strangers, you know, saying it's the fault of Muslims or migrants or this group or that group, and saying that if we could only get rid of those people or stop them coming into our country, then we could deal with the problems of insecurity. This is a very dangerous aspect, which is one of the reasons why I call the precariat the dangerous class. Now, I'm seeing this in Europe, all over Europe. Wherever I'm going to talk about the book, there are far-right groups that are growing very, very fast. They are seriously dangerous, and it's a, you know, reminiscent of the 1930s. At the same time, it's dangerous because the new progressive groups are looking for a much more exciting future. In a sense, it's a very exciting time because this growing precariat is looking, in one way or the other, for an alternative political agenda.
How powerful are groups, though, like the Occupy movement or indeed the Arab Spring uprisings, if they have no specific plan for what they want?
Well, if you look back historically, whenever a new emerging class movement has developed, the initial phase has been very anarchic, and it's taken what I call primitive rebels, you know, a bit like Robin Hood and so on. So the sort of urge is, you know, take from the rich, give to the poor, that sort of thing, and that leads to sort of days of rage, what I call it in the book, where it's lashing out. But very quickly, what you see in terms of historical analogies is a movement away from that phase to a more programmatic one where there's a political agenda that develops around the insecurities and aspirations of the emerging group. The interesting thing is that the politicians so far haven't been listening well enough. But I do notice that a large number now are beginning to make contact. And so I even had a message from the Deputy Prime Minister's office in Britain about the book and about the subject. And I think that you'll see this year a movement away from that Occupy stage where people were brought together and it was a bit sad in some respects and a bit chaotic and so on, to a point where you'll see many more organizations, and we're already seeing that taking place, with a systematic strategy and a political agenda taking shape.
But your concern is that in the meantime they're ripe to be preyed on by perhaps dangerous groups.
Oh, certainly. And I think this is very, very urgent for the political class everywhere to address. And this is one of my key messages, that unless the political class, the commentators, academics, intellectuals, and trade union leaders and women's groups and so on, unless these all wake up to the intense dangers represented by the populists, then we do face a prospect of far-right groups winning. I mean, we're even seeing it in places like Sweden, where the far right has now become one of the major forces in society. And we're seeing it in obviously the Netherlands. We're seeing it in the Tea Party movement, with their crazed attitudes and so on. And it could get very nasty indeed. And therefore, I think it's a matter of extreme urgency that the sensible groups in society look more critically and say, well, our policies have not been addressing the insecurities of ordinary people. And those insecurities are becoming really very threatening. And this sense of fear, it goes right across society, even to fairly affluent families, is not a good way for society to be living.
So what role do democratic governments need to play now?
Well, I think democratic governments, first of all, have got to start listening to what the people in the precariat are saying. And they've got to realize that this is a real group that is emerging of millions of people in their societies that are living roughly similar sorts of existence, you know, with chronic insecurity, with a lack of a sense of occupational identity, lack of a feeling of control over their time, and having to flit between activities, suffering from what I call the precariatized mind, and listen to those concerns, and then say, well, if people are feeling insecure, how do we reduce that insecurity?
Is it possible, though, for individual governments to address this if this is a phenomenon of globalization?
Oh, I think it undoubtedly is something that can be addressed. And one of the activities we're doing at the moment is a development of a precariat charter, a sort of list of policies that national governments could be launching. I think, for example, you've got to move away from welfare programs, which are increasingly coercive and increasingly punitive towards people at the bottom of society. That move, which has been trying to force people into low-paying jobs and out of benefits, is running up against a whole set of contradictions within those policies. And they can do something. There's really no need for a sense of despair. But it is a matter of priorities.
You say that this is fueling a disengagement from traditional political parties, but some would say, is that a problem?
Well, it is a problem because if you have thinner and thinner democracy and people participate less and less, then you get a vacuum developing where people can manipulate very easily with adverts and big powerful money that gets elected politicians who've got an extremist agenda. And I think heavy money politics is a very unhealthy thing, and if that continues, more and more people will become disengaged from democracy, disengaged from being public citizens, and if we all retreat into a sort of privatized existence, that's going to be very unhealthy in the longer term.
Why do you say this is causing a thinning of democracy if Occupy protesters and Arab Spring revolutionaries are on the streets? Isn't that a broadening of democracy?
Well, it would be if it was leading somewhere. But at the same time, and it's not the case in Australia because of the electoral system here, but it in many countries, turnouts at elections have been going down. The percentage of people participating in political parties has been going down. And increasingly, money has been running the political system. So I think that if you have a thinner and thinner democracy, it's a very unhealthy thing for us to be allowing to develop. And the fact that people are participating in Occupy movements is almost a symptom of disillusion with the mainstream real politics.
Guy Standing, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.